Looks like we have a quorum, hey?
We do have a quorum. Just want to go through the rudiments here. Number one, welcome to our first committee hearing. The rules and procedures are in your folders. We don't have any minutes yet. We'll work on that. As we start most of our committees, where I think it'd be good for us to kind of get to know who each other is a little bit, and I'd like us to go around and introduce. I know there's folks that I, honest to God, I don't know. Some I remember. But there's been a lot of turnover, I'm swimming a little bit, keeping up. The older you get, the harder it is with names anyway, right?
So, that's true.
Some of you are old enough to know what I'm talking about. I just would offer to you, and I'll start it out, and we can go wherever we want. I'm John Purcell, representative from District 5A. Some of you I've served with for four terms or more, and 5A is up north central Minnesota. About 30% of my district is water. Say it again. No, I can't hear very good. I'm a chemist by my training and profession, and would have been doing it for 40 years. A lot of environmental work. Worked for tribal government for all 40 of those years. The Leech Lake Indian Reservation is the biggest part of the geography in my district, and that's where a lot of the water is. The Lake Leech Lake, the Winnemagoshi, some of you all been up that way, I'm sure. A lot of tourism up there. Go around here. And our vice chair, Ms. Becker, Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Jamie Becker Finn, I represent Ramsey County suburbs, Roseville, Shoreview, Little Canada, Vadnais Heights, and Gem Lake. Happy to be the vice chair of this committee. I grew up in Cass Lake, which is in Representative or Chair Purcell's district. So, Leech Lake descendant, also a mom of two younger kids. And we spend quite a bit of time up north, and more recently have checked out some deer hunting down south in the CWD zone. So hunt, fish, rice, the trifecta of outdoor Minnesota activities. So really happy to be here, and excited about all the new folks on both sides here. So welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Really pleased to be able to serve on this committee. Dale Lewick, represent District 10B, which is all of Aiken County and a major portion of rural Crow Wing County. We've got 30-40% water like you do, Mississippi River, Mille Lacs Lake, and a whole bunch of stuff like that, Big Sandy. We also have 90% plus of pre-settlement wetlands in the district I represent. We raise a lot of trees up there. Forestry is a huge deal, tourism, and some element of mining in our district. Hunt, fish, and spare time, I still try to raise a few beef cattle. I'm also the GOP lead here for the committee, so looking forward to working with you, Mr. Chair. I know we spent a lot of time on the Veterans Committee here sessions past.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Greg Bowe, representing 47B, which is Eastern Carver County, so Chaska, Chanhassen, and Victoria. I'm a freshman representative, so learning from step one. I've been an environmental professional for 20 years in local county government. Have a Bachelor of Science degree in environmental science and toxicology with a minor in chemistry. And then went back a few years ago to get a master's in public administration. So I enjoy serving local government and look forward to serving on this committee as well. Thank you.
Josh Heitzman. I'm the state representative in Crow Wing County. That's District 10A. Representative Lewick has the rural side of the district. I have the metro side. I run into Dr. Phelps, who's on the agenda today frequently. He's got some interests over in the Brainerd Lakes area, so I'll bump into a Walmart from time to time, either that or a hardware store, and very happy to be serving on this committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dan Fabian. I'm state representative from District 1A, Roseville, Kitson, Marshall, and part of Pennington County. Happy to be on the committee, and, you know, I'm an avid outdoorsman. Representative Beckerfin talked about the trifecta. Well, I think I got about a trifecta times three. I'm not exactly sure, but hunt, fish, all species, avid ATVer and snowmobiler. I do all kinds of trapping. You and I have a lot in common that way. So looking forward to being on the committee, and we'll see what happens this year. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Anderson. I represent District 12B, which is parts of the counties of Pope, Douglas, and Stearns, a strong agricultural area, kind of between St. Cloud and Alexandria along I-94. I'm a farmer, and glad to be on the committee. Thank you.
I'm Steve Green. I represent District 2B, which is all our parts of six counties, serves the White Earth Nation. Also, we have a pretty diverse economy. We go everywhere from agriculture to resorts to logging and industry.
Jean Wagenia is representing South Minneapolis, all the way to the south, and parts of Richfield.
Hi, Mr. Chair. My name is Aisha Gomez. I'm a newly elected representative from District 62B, replacing Susan Allen as she retired. My district is in the heart of Southside Minneapolis. It's right along Lake Street and areas to the south. I'm really pleased to be on this committee. I have a Bachelor of Science in Environmental Science, and so it's sort of like my entree into politics was through environmental justice work in my community. And so I'm happy to be kind of bringing, like, you know, an urban perspective on environmental issues into this space. You know, I think that, like, some of the concerns that I hear from folks are around, you know, environmental health issues that people are facing, air pollution, disproportionate kind of impacts of environmental toxics in low-income communities and indigenous communities, communities of color in Minneapolis. And so, yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm Todd Lippert. I'm representing District 20B, which is Northfield, Lonsdale, Montgomery, just south of the cities. The environment is a major concern of people in my district. It's a major interest and concern of mine, too. Concern of young people in my district, too. We have two colleges in Northfield, and the environment is at the top of their mind. And also securing clean and safe drinking water is an increasing concern for people in rural areas in my district as well.
Good morning. My name is Patty Akam, and I represent 44B, which is the western suburbs out in Minnetonka and Plymouth. And certainly interested in natural resource issues that impact the metro area. I also lived for many years in northwestern Minnesota. My children were born up in the Bemidji area. And we still have a place in greater Minnesota. And so interested in issues affecting natural resource issues affecting both. I'm a former member of the Bowser Board. And I would say that my perspective is looking at the non-game issues. And so my family, my husband and sons all hunt, but I'm not a hunter. And so a lot of the non-game issues are important to me.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Lislegard. I represent 6B. It is the heartland of natural resource-based economy. I'm very, very proud of the Iron Range and our traditions and history in mining, in tourism, and in logging. So I believe that we can do the right thing the right way, and I don't believe it's an either-or. And I think we got some of the best water on the Iron Range, and I look forward to this committee having this discussion.
My name's Rick Hansen. I represent the 40,000 people in northern Dakota County, the cities of South St. Paul, which I share with Representative Claflin, Mendota Heights, West St. Paul, Mendota, and Lilydale. And pleased to be here, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Ann Claflin from 54A. That's the rest of South St. Paul and across the Mississippi River into Newport, St. Paul Park, Cottage Grove, and Gray Cloud Island. I'm a biologist and policy analyst by training and very excited to be here because I really know how important it is to use good science to inform our policy.
Just pleased to hear the science that we have here from everywhere. So thank you for that. I'd like the staff introductions, if I may. So go how you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Sean Herring. I'm the committee administrator, and I'm really looking forward to working with everyone here on the committee.
Hi, I'm Amy Zipko, and I do GOP research.
Margaret Zadra with DFL Research.
I'm Brad Hegemeyer with the House Fiscal Analysis Department. I know it's a policy committee, but I'm here to help out however I can.
I'm Janelle Taylor. I'm with House Research.
Bob Eliff, also with House Research.
And I'm Kevin Petrie, the committee legislative assistant.
And do we have some pages that would introduce, please?
I'm Amanda Schnabel. I live in St. Paul, grew up in St. Cloud, also spent some youth in Hutchinson and New Ulm. I'm Mercedes Tuma Hansen, and I'm from Minneapolis.
Thank you. Well, welcome. And, appreciate your time and commitment, and I guess I want to stop and ask if anybody has any questions about. I know you might not all had a chance to look through the rules, etc. So if things come up, we'll take them on. But if there are questions, you know, let me know, and I'll do my best to answer, or I'll find an answer. So we have today, I think we're ready to proceed with the presentation. We have Nicholas Phelps with us today. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say thanks to the staff for the little trip down memory lane. This takes me back to elementary school, these little I have in my three-ring binder that I used to take down 15th Avenue to get to Clare Barton Elementary. Thank you.
Mr. Phelps is with the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center, and he's going to give us some information, and we'll have some question answer. Mr. Phelps, please proceed.
All right, should be good. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting me to come in for your first session and give you an overview of the progress we made at the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center. I've been with the center since the beginning in 2012 as one of the first faculty members that was working on the invasive species issues in this way, and I've been director of the program since 2016. And I'm not going to take your time explaining the history of aquatic invasive species and the problems they cause here in Minnesota. As you went around and introduced yourselves, there wasn't a district that you mentioned that isn't directly affected by AIS, whether it's the metro water supply or tourism, fisheries, recreation, the economy and the environment. Our way of life here in Minnesota is being impacted. And I can understand this attitude that sometimes comes up of we're losing ground, we've lost hope, this is inevitable, the new normal. But I'd urge this committee to have some hope. There's reasons to be optimistic. There are success stories that pervade all areas of life, but invasive species as well. And here at the University of Minnesota, MACIRC is working to solve these problems. And the state of Minnesota needs to be commended for taking a leadership role in addressing this fight. In 2012, the state came together, stakeholder groups from all varieties, both sides of the aisle, the university, all came in and said, enough's enough. We're not going to give up, that we can't solve today's problems with yesterday's answers, that we have to move the ball forward. And the only way to do that was through research. We had to stop guessing and hoping that something was just going to change. So science can make a difference, and a persistent effort is the way forward. So we formed this center with the mission to develop research-based solutions that can reduce impacts of AIS in Minnesota by preventing spread, controlling populations, and managing ecosystems. And really importantly, to advance knowledge to inspire action by others. This was a research group doing set out to do high-quality science, but also make sure that it was being implemented at the state and local level, so it wasn't just getting stuck in some peer-reviewed journal. So you're going to see this kind of pervade the rest of the talk here, and I'm going to give you an update of some of the specific research projects. This slide's a little bit out of date now, but we have just over 30 PhD-level scientists working on this problem. They're affiliated with the program from state and federal agencies, different universities, and a lot at the University of Minnesota. I've managed to build this capacity through collaboration. They aren't all directly and fully supported by the center, but they bring expertise to bear from very diverse skill sets. We have absolutely brilliant graduate students who are bringing their creativity and motivation to solve these problems. They are really passionate. They're out there in the fields. They're the ones actually doing the work. We have an advisory board that includes the commissioner of DNR and other high-level federal, tribal, and local representatives. We've got a couple of Lake Association members, nonprofit groups, and AIS professionals, keeping us true to our mission, making sure that we're solutions-oriented. Mm-hmm. And then a technical committee that has specific expertise on research and management directions. We're based at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, but we work all over the state. I don't think that there's a district here that we don't have active research going on in. I mean, it's not just about going out and doing the work in these places. We've made a deliberate attempt, and this isn't the academic norm, but the value of a center is we've been able to coordinate efforts with the local managers and communities. We've managed to get them engaged, not with just the development of the research, but participating and volunteering with this work. And they're being brought together with us, so when it comes time to implement, they have the resources and information that they need. And you can click on this interactive map if you go to the website, and you can click on each one of these dots in your district and see exactly what we're doing, who did it, and it brings back to some of the main project page information. I believe real strongly, and I'll acknowledge my bias here, but I do believe that what we've been able to create at MACIRC is the most effective and efficient way to move the ball forward with research-based solutions. It's not cheap. We never thought research would be an inexpensive effort, but I do believe it's been money well spent. We've been generously supported by the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund since 2012, Clean Water Fund, and in the last biennium we were supported in the environment bill that helped really provide some of that base support, that stable funding that's really important and hard to really plan long-term efforts when you're jumping grant to grant. Just so you're aware, we have been recommended by the LCCMR and are part of that ENRTF proposal that is moving through this session. And I'm hopeful that as you all sort out your many funding priorities, that MACIRC remains a priority as well in the environment bill. There has been an incredible amount of research progress that's been made. I've passed out the 2018 research summary. These are just bullet points of huge efforts, so it's hard to distill it down in any kind of adjustable way in one page, but I'm going to try to give you an overview of the last 6 years to give you just a sense of the approach we're taking, some highlights and some of the progress we've made. And I'll try to save some time for questions at the end so we can dive a little bit deeper. So if I touch on something, just flag it and follow up with a question either after I get done speaking, or I'm happy to come back over here and meet with you one-on-one or as a group to dive into a specific topic in particular. I do want to make clear, though, that the work we do isn't just this. It might start to sound as this kind of scattered shot of various projects, but I want to assure you that the value of the center is that I'm able to sit there in the middle of it all and look across everybody's effort and coordinate everything else that's going on. We spend a lot of time with a lot of people trying to prioritize their efforts as well. It's overwhelming. There's dozens of species causing problems in the state now, hundreds, maybe thousands that could be introduced into the state. How do we pick which ones to work on, and how do we approach those problems when the issues could expand or the needs could expand from impacts, prevention, early detection, control, and management? So I'm going to ask for a little bit of trust here, and I can come back to it in the questions if you want to know more, but we do have a process to prioritize and stay focused on solutions-oriented and collaborative research. There isn't if I were to poll, ask you guys right now, which species might be the highest priority for your district or what you're hearing about most, my guess is going to be zebra mussels. I don't think that there's anybody here not affected by zebra mussels right now, or people in your district actively dealing with it at this moment. So I'm going to give a little more in-depth overview on zebra mussel research, spanning that spectrum from impacts down to management and the work we're doing and the progress we've made. But keep in mind that all of this, pretty much everything I'm going to mention, is active. It's in progress. It's happening in real time. We're learning as we go. We're not complete with any of this. We don't have all the answers quite yet, but you'll get a sense, hopefully, that we are moving the ball forward. And the first one, impacts. We assume, you all approach this from policy and policy perspectives and management, is that we've got this problem on our hands. But to really do something about it, we have to understand the scale and the degree of this impact and how it's impacting the environment or economy or our way of life, right? I can say that this is causing a problem, but how much? We can't adaptively manage in the face of these problems if we don't know what the problem is. So I'm going to play this quick video, let the researchers speak for themselves on what they're trying to do to understand impacts, because this one might resonate well with this committee. So hopefully the sound plays here.
The main point of this project is to understand the impacts of spiny water flea and zebra mussels on walleye and other fish. And we know about the impacts that these invasive species have on food that walleye rely on at certain parts of their life, but we don't know if walleye are able to kind of switch to other prey sources, and if they are, if they can do that everywhere or only in certain kinds of lakes. So we're visiting 9 large walleye lakes in Minnesota, so that includes Cass, Winnebogoshish, Leech, Mille Lacs, Red, Lake of the Woods, Vermilion, Rainy, and Cabotogama. That's 9. Zebra mussels are a small invasive mussel that has invaded a number of Minnesota lakes that we know has a lot of impacts on the bottom of the food web and clearing up water. And spiny water flea are an invasive zooplankton species that eat native zooplankton and cause their numbers to go down, which can be a problem for fish who rely on those zooplankton for food. So we'll take the samples that we collect here today, which are fish and snails, insects, things like that, and we'll send them off to a lab to look at their chemical composition in a way that will tell us who's eating who in the lake and how that might change when lakes get invaded. And we're also looking at changes in growth rate of walleye and yellow perch using data collected over the past 25 years or so by DNR staff to understand how growth rates of young fish might change when lakes get invaded.
Generally, we just study walleye size, age, and growth, that kind of thing, and then move on to yellow perch and go species by species. But here we're integrating not only all the fish species to look at how they interact, but also invertebrates, which we usually never have the time to or money to look at. The project is really exciting, and it's a topic I'm really passionate about, and I think it really matters to our citizens, not just people who fish, but also people who live on the lakes and love our lakes.
Mm-hmm. So that project's led by Dr. Gretchen Hansen in collaboration with the University of Minnesota Duluth, the Natural Resource Research Institute, the DNR, National Park Service. There's a lot of collaborators that have come together and brought a lot of perspectives and data to bear on this. And I just heard Dr. Gretchen just the other day, so hot off the press, it hasn't been, the project has a couple months left, and so they're not entirely final, but the trend seems obvious that from these nine large walleye lakes, the impacts to young of year walleye are significant. They do grow slower in lakes that have zebra mussels and spiny water flea. So slower growing fish reduces survival that first year, and you can see how this might play up at the ecosystem and fisheries level. Now, what does a manager do with that information? A fisheries manager can build. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just on that study, how many of those nine lakes currently have both spiny water flea and zebra mussels?
Just Lake Mille Lacs.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so it's the nine walleye lakes, just for a little more information there. It serves as an amazing case study right now. They span the spectrum of uninvaded, like red lakes, both invasive species like Mille Lacs. Some just have spiny and some just have zebras. So we have the chance now to kind of look at history of invasion in different ways. But the walleye do grow slower with zebra mussels alone, spinies alone, and both together. So fisheries managers can start to manage in the face of this. Rethink your population dynamic models and what you might expect to survive in that second year if you know this kind of information.
I just got a quick question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Does this information, and I'm not going to try and get too far in the weeds, no pun intended, but does this information that the research they're doing include parasites, fish parasites, for instance?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it sure does.
So they're looking at cestodes, do you know for sure? Or?
Not cestodes specifically. We're working on invasive pathogens as well, and I'll touch on that briefly in a few slides, but it's not directly related to this impacts.
There's some history of cestode work, particularly on Mille Lacs. That's why I was involved with it. That's why I'm asking.
Okay.
Thank you.
Prevention. There's nothing more contentious maybe in an invasive species issue than how to prevent the spread. You can't prevent the spread if you don't know how they move. And we've had guesses over the years. The managers have been working with the best information available, but we've spent a lot of time on this topic. We've created a zebra mussel family tree, like ancestry.com of zebra mussels. Mm-hmm. You can connect the genetic relatedness of populations to see where they've spread over the landscape. And a couple takeaways, management-relevant takeaways from this. We now know that there are these clustered hotspots of invasion. In the Brainerd area, they're all genetically indistinguishable, same in Alex, same in DL. They get introduced to a region, a lake-rich area, and it spreads quickly within that region. This has debunked the super spreader hypothesis. Many people were pointing the finger at Lake Mille Lacs, as that was infested early, heavily infested, big popular lake. There isn't anything else connected genetically with Mille Lacs. So something that they're doing in Mille Lacs, some intervention that's happening there, is working. There is a way to prevent spread. So what can we learn from the Mille Lacs scenario to help other lakes? We've also learned that within a lake population, the genetic diversity is high. This shows us that when these lakes become seeded with their first zebra mussels come in, it's a lot of individuals at a time. That's the best guess. A bunch comes in at once, either on a dock or a boat lift or something, or a clump of vegetation that's on a boat comes in at one time and seeds the lake. It's much less likely that it's a whole bunch of few individual introductions. That makes sense? So that's it kind of decreases on the risk level the possibility of waterfowl, for example. It's much less likely that they're playing any major role. Much more likely that these big clumps of mussels are coming in at one time. So something for managers to keep in mind as they're looking at prevention.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So essentially it's D-Day versus commando type of invasions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that seems to be the case. At least that's the trend. That might not always happen that way, but that the genetics are pointing in that direction for sure.
Mr. Chair, follow up. And are those clusters connected in the same watersheds? Are those watersheds separated so that is there movement of water between those lake and river systems, or are they are there separations within those clusters by watershed? If you understand what.
Yep, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that's a great question, and a lake is much more likely to become infested if it's connected by water to an infested lake. We know that's the case, and in these hot spots, they are oftentimes connected by water. We've done some research in that area. I'll come back to some of the spread stuff in just a minute and answer that question maybe a little more clearly. We've also looked at boats. Everyone points their fingers at boats as a pathway for spread of zebra mussels and bellagers, that juvenile life stage that we can't see that can be in the residual water. So looking at actual boats that have come out of Gull Lake and Crow Wing, Cass counties and Lake Minnetonka, we've quantified the amount of residual water. And a long story short, there is water. It's in the boat. It cannot be drained through standard practices. And there are bellagers in that water. They are a risk factor. So what have we been doing to mitigate that risk? MESRC researchers have been working with the American Boat and Yacht Council, and they just recently made formal recommendations to boat manufacturers on redesign strategies to reduce risk of residual water transport. That's an important progress point there. We've evaluated the use of antifreeze for decontaminating inboard engines. That's something they use to winterize them, but we know now we've dialed it in at a concentration that can safely kill them if you wanted to decon a boat at other points in time or ballast water held in a wakeboard boat. We've also looked at the efficacy of using vacuums. This is becoming a more popular discussion point, more thorough inspections in decon. And while vacuuming does help, it still can't reach all the residual water left in the boat. So boats remain probably this in the category of a high-frequency, low-risk event. Early detection is critical if we have any hope of preventing more spread or responding quickly. It's an overwhelming thing. We've got thousands of lakes in the state. Very few people actually looking. There's really little active surveillance that goes on. We rely largely on people finding it at the end of their dock and reporting it to the DNR. So how can we shrink that haystack? So we've been combining massive data sets and through modeling approaches or partnered with veterinary and public health epidemiologists to look at water connectivity, boater movement networks, and environmental suitability. Combine them all into this model to predict the risk at the lake level for every single lake in the state. There are spreadsheets on this website that break it out. Every single lake in your county, you could look up what the likelihood is that zebra mussels are going to show up. And just to give you a sense of the predictability of this and how useful it could be for surveillance, in Beltrami County last year, 580 or so lakes in that county, one lake became infested, and it was predicted to be the highest risk lake, Lake Bemidji. In Ramsey County, just around here, about 200 lakes in the county, both lakes that became infested with zebra mussels were in the top 10 predicted risk. So there is a lot of power in this model. Huge data has gone in to inform it, and it can really help more strategically inform the way we do surveillance and early detection efforts. And all of this information is, we've been getting this out in the hands of the county and statewide managers. Now we know where,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick question. You're talking about the important work you're doing and how important it is to detect early and that you're doing looking at a small number of lakes and that, as we all know, we are the land of 10,000-plus lakes. And so I'm wondering if in your efforts to reach more lakes, have you considered citizen scientry or volunteer scientists to help expand that scope? We have a state full of a lot of outdoors people that want to be involved. I think the Christmas bird count is a prime example of good data that can be brought by volunteers and citizens. So just wondering if you've considered that option in your efforts.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is a, it sounds like a planted question. We do have a citizen science program. I can't wait to tell you about it in a couple slides. And we're super proud of it. It's an amazing effort in making, it's a success story for sure.
Thank you.
So how do you find zebra mussels? Scuba surveys, this is just the video, try to count them. This is what DNR and managers do. They start swimming around trying to find these mussels, and it's incredibly hard. There's a bunch there, hard to see. When you look for early infestations, I should point out, this is the requirement of any kind of treatment effort. That's a lot of them, I thought. That's the requirement of treatment efforts, to go out and quantify the distribution of an infestation in a lake. And it's really hard. The accuracy is very poor. We know that. So we've been doing analyzing the trade-offs between covering a lot of ground and missing stuff, or looking in focused areas and getting more. We're also innovating with technology, using multi-beam sonars to try to find things that we know now that they can distinguish between a zebra mussel shell and a native mussel shell and everything else in the lake. We can see them with sonar. And we're also improving the efficiency of environmental DNA collection manifold.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question on, I learned a long time ago, one of the most ineffective ways to find things in the water is use divers. Mm-hmm. One of the more effective ways, you mentioned sonar as well as underwater cameras. Have you looked at, and this is probably out of the biologist's realm of expertise, have you looked at the at how best those equipments can be tuned to find that stuff? Because that is an extremely specialized world, depending on what you're looking for. If it's metal, whoopee. If it's soft, ouch, mm-hmm. It's really hard. So that's an area I hope we're really looking at. Can you go into a little more detail on that, if we have looked at that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lubick, that's a great question, and this is it's a good example of why the center adds value. We've been able to build capacity on that specific topic with the development of the multi-beam sonar. You're right; it's a technology that exists. We have sonars for various things, but working with the St. Anthony Falls Laboratory at the University of Minnesota, the USGS, and an incredible researcher at the make sure I get this right. It's the Northern Arizona University, I believe. He's in Arizona. He's got national level reputation on dialing this in and evaluating the results. And so you can tweak it a little bit, and that is improving the efficiency and detectability of just finding the zebra mussels. So we're working on that.
To give you an example, we've been able to recover things at 25,000, 30,000 feet that were minuscule, but we had to find them first, and I'm talking about the Department of Defense. So, spread your net wide there, because there's a tremendous amount of technology where they've had to solve some pretty difficult problems.
That's for sure. Control of zebra mussels is a high priority topic for MACER. We've been working on this since the very beginning. And we've progressed in a safe way, research from controlled laboratory experiments to small-scale field studies. And this coming year, we're going to be, starting in May, we'll be scaling that up to about a 25-acre part of a bay in Lake Minnetonka. At each step, we learn more and we refine our options. We've published a white paper that provides protocols for managers on killing zebra mussels in small, isolated areas. We can kill zebra mussels. That's not the question anymore. Where we're at now is how we can control zebra mussels while minimizing the non-target impacts. So this next project really looks to focus on that, to make sure we're not doing more harm than good with our control efforts. But we're also, the technology also exists, and this might seem wild to some, but if you talk to the agriculture industry and human health, this has become status quo almost. The technology exists to edit genomes with precision, and in theory, we could drive populations to extinction. We started down this road, one of MACERC's first projects, and I'm happy to report that very soon we're going to be announcing the culmination of a five-year effort to sequence the zebra mussel genome. We've done it. And where that goes from here is a bit unpredictable because this opens up huge areas of science for us. But just imagine for a second if you could turn off one of the genes that controls the growth of the Bissell threads or shell formation. So the zebra mussels can't attach or they can't survive. They'll die. That's one way to do it. So we're moving down that road. It's a very long one. We're moving at the same time, I can assure you, looking not just at technology developments but at the environmental risk. We're working very closely with federal and state regulators to talk about the pathways for an approach like this. And also, it may be equally as important as everything else, or more so, the ethical and social implications of intentionally releasing a genetically engineered animal into the environment. That has been proposed for conservation. They're doing it with mosquitoes, for example, for human health. But in this area, it would be novel, and it's something we need to tread lightly into. But we are, no doubt, moving forward in the research way. Management, we have to deal with the problem, clearly, that we have right now. So we've been, that watercraft movement, the boater connectivity stuff I mentioned briefly, we've used that and worked with a guy from the U.S. Forest Service. He's a pro in building algorithms for decision optimization. And we can strategically put watercraft inspectors on the landscape at boat ramps to maximize their effectiveness. So Crow Wing County has deployed this strategy for 2019 and working with Stearns, Ramsey, and Washington counties to pilot this right now as well. You want to make sure this has local relevance. It's one thing to have a model. It's another thing to roll it out to the public and really change decision making. And so we're getting into this area, and it's also useful, I should point out, what this figure shows is that there is eventually diminishing returns for inspections. And you can use a model like this to evaluate the cost benefits. At some point, adding more inspectors doesn't get you an equal amount of reduced risk. So where can we dial in an efficiency here with management with the limited resources we have? And we're getting this out into the hands of the local people. That's an overview of zebra mussels. There's a ton there, and I've talked way too long. There is more to go with impacts. We need to understand trends over time. We're looking at a snapshot right now. Prevention, we need to bring in the social science people. We need research in that area to look at behavior change and willingness to comply and why people are motivated to do things. With early detection, we've made a lot of progress there, but there's still work to do to continue to refine and tweak the methods. Control, we'll scale this up, and eventually I can't wait to the day when we test this at a whole lake level and make progress in management. We'll always be working with managers to continue to better spend our resources.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to share with the committee, so if you like hearing more details and want more details, you said you talked a lot about zebra mussels, but you could actually go to their research showcase and spend an entire day attending different talks just on zebra mussels. So they do a research showcase every September over at the U of M, and it's been one of the most helpful events, you know, conferences that I've attended that's really been helpful in a deeper understanding of the science of these issues. So just wanted to give a shout out to the research showcase every year. Usually there's only like maybe two, maybe three legislators who attend, but it's also open to the public, and just wanted to highlight that because I had already seen a lot of this because I went to it in September. So thank you for putting that on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Becker-Finn. Thank you very much. It's great to see you there every year. Is that a question? Okay, so I'll just...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Phelps, thanks for what you do there. I'm curious to know, and you mentioned zebra mussels, obviously, and they've been in the United States for 30, 40 years or something like that. Walk me through what collaboration is going on, so say between the University of Minnesota and maybe the University of Michigan. Who else is doing research on this? And you talk about treatments, you know, when there is an infestation. Can you explain to us what some of the treatments are?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that's a great question. And to elaborate a bit more on the collaboration, first on the research side of it, we are unique here in Minnesota to have a research center. This program is really unlike any other. There are brilliant researchers around the world working on various things, but not in the same kind of coordinated and collaborative way. We've been able to bring a lot of these people together on specific projects and also to advise the center on a bigger picture. Excuse me. So I'll give you an example of my own research program. I'm actively working with researchers in China, Australia, across the country, Canada, Germany, all focused on common carp control here in Minnesota. So we're reaching out. Anybody's got expertise we're interacting with, but it's all focused, and because they're state dollars, it's being driven by Minnesota. So I think that's something to appreciate. How do we roll this out, then, the partnerships and collaborations that we have with managers from the federal to the local levels? And I include agency as well as other stakeholder groups that are involved with this issue. I use stakeholder as a pretty broad term. We work closely with them in the development of projects, actively engage them during the work, and we walk with them to make sure that the research is translated to them in a usable way. So for the rapid response, the pilot program for controlling zebra mussels, when they get a new infestation, they have worked with the University of Minnesota to figure out the extent of the infestation, what treatment recommendations to do, how to survey it post, and how to monitor post-treatment, along with DNR, watershed districts, and everybody else. We are a seat at the table in pretty much every discussion right now at the local level, watershed, county, state, federal. I'm on regional panels. I travel internationally to talk to people about this stuff. Long story short, I don't know who else we could work with, and we're making sure that we're bringing the best and brightest together on this topic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. One other question. I asked about treatments a little bit, too. You said, can you tell me what you do for treatments, and maybe you've been up to Lake Winnipeg and seen what they've tried to do with potash or some of those things.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, we've tried to learn as much as we can from treatments. The active management or active treatment that happens to control a population has largely been management-led, and our research has helped to inform it. So we've had a seat at the table as they come up with their plan, and we've learned everything we could after the fact so we can apply it to other lessons for future treatments. Maybe another example for for curly-leaf pondweed, there's been hundreds, maybe thousands of treatments for curly-leaf pondweed across the state, people dumping chemicals, herbicides into the lake, trying to control the species. And we've been aggregating all this data, learning as much as we can from managers. We can identify trends now and make more efficient and effective recommendations going forward.
And then one last thing, Mr. Chair, and this is probably between you and me and the rest of the committee. One of the things that really has become very, very concerning to a lot of people, and I'm sure it is in your area, too, is the hybrid cattails and how we're dealing with those here in the state of Minnesota. And I think we really need to figure out a different path to chart, to start making some attempts to letting local people control their hybrid cattails and so forth. I'm kind of interested in what your thoughts would be at some point. Doesn't have to be today, but I'd like to talk about that.
We'll follow up on that. They've been here a while. And, we'll talk about that. Maybe we can get some input from the invasive center. That's one of the long-standing invasives, if you will.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we do have a researcher who's got some background in that species.
Okay. So that may be good, Representative Fabian. We'll get some more information on it. I want to ask you, Dr. Pelt, do you want one of the pages to get you a glass of water? I heard you coughing there a little bit, and I've been there, done that. Just if you do, we'll get it. So there you go.
I'm getting over a cold. Well, if it was a glass of water, I'd drink
it. Go ahead.
I'm pretty low maintenance.
We'll do our best to keep you upright here for the rest of the time. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was getting a little thirsty, too. Dr. Phelps, I've been to some presentations where they've talked about quagga mussels and quagga mussels moving more through the Great Lakes. And so you've mentioned that you've successfully mapped the zebra mussel. Could you maybe highlight the difference, or if you're doing any work on quagga mussels, and how much are they coming into the state?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the quagga mussels are one of those big-time threats on the doorstep. We have been looking at that closely. We don't have active research specifically on quagga mussels right now, but we've done so much for zebra mussels that I think we could that we could learn from and apply to quaggas. They have, in the United States, moved through the same pathways, marching right behind the zebras. And for those of you not familiar, in the Great Lakes, they've, in many areas, almost entirely displaced the zebra mussels. They seem to be more resilient. They grow deeper. They grow larger. They're perhaps, some people consider, a bigger problem. They're not here yet. But the same things, the prevention efforts, the pathways, a lot of that could be applied to the quaggas.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. A question on, you know, zebra mussels have been a problem for quite a while. I think if we further east we look, the bigger problem they've been. Do we have a reasonably clear picture on the end state of a watershed or collection of lakes that have been infested for many, many years? In other words, you know, what's the take on what, how that environment changed, obviously particularly with the fish, because in a lot of places we're still watching it because we get this big whoops, there's a ton of them, and then they kind of eat themselves a little bit. So what do we know about the end state for places that have been really infected for a long time?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. It varies by lake. Not every lake is a good walleye lake. Not every lake is a good zebra mussel lake. So there are places where they cause bigger problems than others. In places where they do cause problems, what we see is the, and this doesn't take long, I mean, the population kind of creeps along a bit and then exponentially grows. And you'll get this boom and bust with highly fecund species like this, boom and bust cycles. That's the natural process. We'll see pretty quickly after the population spikes, the water will get clearer. Lake Mille Lacs is much clearer than it used to be. This is going to change the food web. We don't always know in what ways, and some of this impact research that Dr. Hansen was talking about in that video was looking at the food webs. And what they're starting to see is that it pushes the fishery offshore. So the feeding becomes more of an open water ecosystem. And if there's no open water ecosystem for the fish to go to, the population will collapse. It will go down. If there is, perhaps it can be more resilient. So it's going to play out in different ways in each one, but there are some lakes, many lakes, where it's a very different world in that lake now that zebra mussels are established, and not often for the better. So just I'll move really quick. I'm not sure exactly how much time I have left, but we're good? Okay. I'm just going to highlight at a very high level the plants and some of the other areas we're working on. Invasive plants, huge problem. Starry stonewort, one of Minnesota's newest invaders, showed up in 2015. Because the center was here, we immediately mobilized a workshop that brought in international expertise to help us work with the DNR and others to identify knowledge gaps and management options. What we learned very quickly, and perhaps weren't too surprised to find out, that there's very little that we knew about starry stonewort. Like zebra mussels, we ramped up efforts very fast, and there's a lot that's been accomplished. I'm not going to go into the details, but a long story short, we're really understanding this thing much better now in the last this last year and a half or so. There are decisions being influenced. Things are happening differently now at the management level because of what we've learned with starry stonewort. We're also looking at Eurasian water milfoil. I'm sure you've all heard about that, but what we've come to find is that people were treating for Eurasian water milfoil, and there were these events where the Eurasian water milfoil wasn't dying. There seemed to be this resistant variety, and we've now learned through genetics that it's this hybrid milfoil. So not just the Eurasian that we've got to worry about, now we've got this hybrid species, and we're trying to understand now the distribution in the state and correlate that with treatment outcomes so we can better inform the professionals out there that are applying herbicides so they're not wasting money if they have this hybrid species that won't be affected. Curly-leaf pondweed, I mentioned that one briefly. We're also doing a bunch with non-native Phragmites. That might be one that comes up as it relates to wastewater treatment. The non-native Phragmites have been able to map the distribution in the state. We've developed management recommendations. They're online and in the hands of managers right now. And we're currently working with several state agencies and local land managers to develop a statewide management response in a coordinated way. What could we do about non-native Phragmites in the state to control spread? What are our options? And put it out there and see how people react. So that's a good story there, too. Invasive carp is a success story. Research was going on here in common carp before the center was created. But the progression, you look back over time and watch the progression of this work from basic science, laboratory experiments, to now being able to control carp in multiple chains of lakes, and ultimately resulting in a spin-off company from the university who's now out there controlling carp based on the research that's been generated. This is a species that we have a lot of options for. There are ways to refine it and get better, and we still have some things to learn, but we do have some options, and there is active management going on for common carp. And the invasive carp, the big head and silver, the ones you see the YouTube videos about swimming up the Mississippi River, we've taken laboratory experiments with deterrents, sound and bubbles and light, and now placed that at locks in the lock systems, specific lock and dam number 8, and are monitoring the effectiveness. How can we deter this fish from swimming up? We've also spent a fair bit of time looking at the hydrodynamics of the locks. How can we work with the Army Corps of Engineers to dial in those gates so that flow rate is just right in that sweet spot, so it doesn't affect the engineering or the environment, but prevents the carp from swimming through? And there's a way to do that, and we can greatly reduce the number of fish that have the chance to swim through by working with the Army Corps, and this is all out in the hands of the federal partners right now. I mentioned harmful microbes, parasites, viruses, they're out there, just like the other species that are bigger and maybe higher profile. We don't have a lot going on right now specifically related to the invasive microbes. One of the early projects on the VHS virus, which is something you might be familiar with, big high-profile issue for the state back in the late 2000s, about 10 years ago. One of the first projects with the center we created a risk management strategy for the DNR. It was implemented by the commissioner, and coincidentally or not, we're still free of this virus, despite the fact that it persists on our doorstep. We're looking at pathways. We can't just focus on the species, the biology and physiology of an individual. We also look at the systems in which they move and how people are involved with all of this. This is also an area where we've created citizen science. So our AIS detectors program is awesome. I'm very proud of the partnership that we have with the University of Minnesota Extension. We have about 230 citizen scientists, certified AIS detectors scattered about the state. They're all over the place. They're not only an active, engaged, educated local resource that has contributed north of 7,000 volunteer hours in the last couple of years, but they've also been responsible for finding several new infestations. And if we could quantify the amount of money that might be saved by protecting a lake, finding it early and getting rid of it, I might think this program is money well spent. They went into Grand Lake and Stearns County and working with DNR and lake associations. They found it early. They've been working to control it, and it has not spread outside of that little tiny patch yet. And with persistent effort, we're hopeful, managers are hopeful, that it'll stay under control or perhaps go away if we can keep it suppressed over time. So that's a success story. You'll see them all over. If you ever are in your district and you want an AIS person, look up one of the detectors. They're out there. They're excited to help. We do the academic thing. We've published, more than 50 papers in the last 5 years. We present at local, international conferences, and I can assure you that our science and the approach we're taking is well respected internationally. People are learning from us as much or more so as we're learning from them. But equally as important, we've spent a ton of time doing maybe the non-academic thing. This is the value of the center. We have a communication specialist who can help translate the science, take that peer-reviewed paper, and put it into a digestible chunk that people can understand, that managers can like use. They don't want this 25-page scientific jargon. They want this 4-page protocol. So how do we get to that point? We've done a lot of work there producing these white papers and management recommendations. We're active on social media. We get the message out to the public. We have our newsletter is open like 56,000 times last year. We produced these 6 videos. You saw one of them earlier. Just in the last 2 months, they've been viewed over 30,000 times. We have our annual showcase. Last year, 270 people came. We present around the states. People show up. This is not. These aren't just people. This is impressive to me. These aren't just people who are kicking the tires on AIS. What is zebra mussels going to do in my lake? These are people following us, tracking the research. They're interested in the science of it. They're optimistic that we can find something, and they're coming along on the ride. So it's great to have this engaged group of people out there. We've accomplished a whole heck of a lot in the last since 2012, since we were created. I'm very proud of what we've been able to do. I'm very optimistic about the path we're on and that solutions are attainable, that we don't have any reason to believe that this is inevitable or that we should lose hope or this is the new normal. I really do think, is me speaking professionally and personally, that we have a response, not only a responsibility to find a solution, but we can. And I think we're on the right path. We do have a long ways to go, though. When we created this center, we were over here begging for patience, and I'm asking for patience still. Despite the progress we made, we still have some work to do. We never sold anybody on the idea that research was a quick fix. Science never is. This isn't the genius sitting in the lab having eureka moments. This is incremental steps, hard work, and persistence that eventually pays off. And we see this in all aspects of life, things that we do now that were informed in similar ways through research. And I don't think that our natural resource problems, as big and complicated as they are, cannot be overcome. So thank you very much for your support in these issues. This is clearly a priority for you, and I thank you for everything that you've done.
Thank you, Dr. Phelps, and Representative Wiginia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Phelps, I'm just especially appreciative of your work on the common carp. I was sitting here figuring out that it was either 6 or 7 years ago that I remember DNR telling me there's nothing you can do about the common carp. So when folks tell you there's nothing you can do, I think we need to go to you guys. But my specific question is, a long time ago, the university was involved with this is a terrestrial invasive, the leafy spurge. Mm-hmm. And they went to the source of the leafy spurge, I think it was in Asia, and found a beetle that is controlling leafy spurge in Minnesota. Not ridding it, but it's keeping the population way down, and we're different from North Dakota, I think, has leafy spurge all over the place. Are you doing the same kind of going to the source and looking for things that were the natural, whatever it is, keeping that in check?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wiginia said, thank you for the comments on the common carp. Great story on keeping the optimism going. Specifically on finding that every species has a weakness, and for many in their native range, it's disease or a pest or something that keeps them in check. We have not pursued that very hard yet at the center. We've taken a different strategy, though, trying to find native things that the invasives may not have ever been exposed to that could be just as effective. They're coming into this novel ecosystem. There are things that they're naive to. And I hope that we can find something. And we're working on pathogenic control for common carp and zebra mussels and milfoil right now. And the common carp story, there is a virus that is out there causing huge mortality events in common carp right now. It's in the state. We just found it last year, but it seems to be widespread now. Just in the last few years, there's been about 15 of these large-scale mortality events. Could we harness that virus and put it into other places in a more appropriate time to even increase that mortality event? That research is active and ongoing. And so I don't know that it's I would not say that I'm against that idea. It just hasn't been something we've pursued quite yet.
Well, I know it took a long time to do the leafy spurge because you had to make sure that there were none unintended consequences, but there could be unintended consequences from the virus that's getting the carp. So you've got to look at unintended consequences no matter. But I would suggest, just because of the success story of the beetle that keeps leafy spurge in check, that that is also a route to pursue. Because, I mean, this is kind of an all hands on deck because of climate change and the warming of the state. We're going to have more problems. So it does seem we have to have a full menu, if you will, of solutions.
Well, thank you.
I have a question to follow, I'm going to follow up on the common carp, and I date myself a little bit, but back in the day, common carp were netted pretty hard for pet food. Is that still going on?
Mr. Chair, common carp, there is a commercial fishery for common carp. There are people who are licensed, permitted by the state to go out and harvest them. The value isn't there to really support a commercial fishery anymore, is my sense. And the it seems as though most of the people doing it are doing it more for management reasons and being paid not for the cat food, but for from watershed districts who are trying to improve water quality. So it's a different economic model, but nevertheless, there's still people doing it.
That fits with what I have been advised, that the pet food industry wasn't so interested anymore in carp. So other questions? We've got 15, 20 minutes yet, Pierce. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you mentioned starry stonewort, and that seems to be kind of a very hard plant to deal with. So. Could you maybe talk a little bit about starry stonewort and how much it's been able to establish itself, or kind of your research efforts there?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, the starry stonewort story is a long one, but I'll try to make it brief. For those of you not familiar with starry stonewort, it showed up here in 2015, first found in Lake Coronas in Stearns County. It looks like a plant. But it's technically a macroalgae. This is an important feature to understand for management, because you can't apply an herbicide in the same way you would for milfoil or curly leaf. It doesn't have a vascular structure to suck in an herbicide to the throats and kill it. So all you can really do is treat it and give it a haircut. It kills that next cell, and then it kills the next cell. And so the management right now is a persistent problem. And it's tricky just because it's macroalgae. It moves around. It gets its name from a starry-shaped bulbul. It's analogous to a potato, a little starch-filled pocket of energy that can resprout to make new plants. It can persist in the environment for quite some time in the sediment. And it can move around on boats in various pathways, just like any other plant. And resprout in new areas. When they found it in Lake Coronas, it was about maybe 150 acres or so. It was a big acre. It was a big area of the lake. They didn't know what it was. It wasn't on the radar here in Minnesota. It wasn't on our watch list. It wasn't on the DNR website. It wasn't on our priority species list either. This is one of those things that just showed up. The work we've done, though, in response, and maybe I'll talk through it in kind of that impact to management direction. We're looking at impacts. How bad is it? We've set up study plots in lakes to monitor the progression of invasion over time. We found that not only will starry stonewort rapidly colonize areas that have no other plants, it will also start to outcompete areas that have plants, reducing the diversity of native vegetation. This displacement is a big concern for an environmental perspective. It grows very dense, it grows very thick, and it can mat at the surface of the water, preventing recreation. So the impacts cut across both economic and environmental. We've looked at prevention efforts. Those simulations that I did for zebra mussels, that risk ranking, we also did that with starry stonewort. So I can predict which lakes will get starry stonewort just as easily as I can with zebra mussels. And the predictability, for better or worse, we're validating these models now with real-life outbreaks, and the predictability is pretty dang strong. We've also looked at prevention for early detection, that kind of overlap there with our early detectors program, the Starry Trek event. 200 people go out in August and look at boat ramps looking for this. We bring them to central locations within each county. They get trained. They go out. They look. And they find, for better or worse, they find new things. So that early detection effort's been pretty critical. We've also looked at desiccation rates. How long can different size clumps of starry stonewort survive out of water? What is the risk? Can we quantify the risk of boats transporting it over land? There's a pretty precipitous decline. It dries out quickly because it's a macroalgae. It doesn't retain water in some ways like a plant would. And so it's pretty intolerant to drying out. But the bigger the clump you get, the wetter it can stay. And if you have a wet spot in your boat, it could last a while. And those bubbles can last a fair bit of time, an order of days, between lakes. Control in the lab right now, we have starry stonewort growing. If you come to campus, we have a containment facility. It's an incredible lab that allows us to safely do this research. And you'll find a whole bunch of beakers set up with little tiny starry stonewort plants or macroalgae growing in each one. And we're testing various concentrations and different types of algicides to dial in that treatment recommendation. What's being used out in the landscape, and they're spending tons of money trying to treat it in some of these lakes right now, we know it's not 100% effective. It's just nuisance control, really. So we're trying to, and it's really expensive, so we're trying to dial in those options in a controlled way in the lab. That's our control effort. And for management, we're working with DNR and with counties on how best to find it, how best how to educate people on identifying it and informing watercraft inspection location based on the presence or absence of the species to maximize their ability to intercept a risky boat. So that's the long story short.
Representative Baker.
Did you have a follow-up?
No. Follow-up. Just a follow-up.
Yes. Go ahead. Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So freezing doesn't affect the cell, that our temperatures are, there's no impact in our climate with freezing or heat or temperature?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, there, if it freezes, it dies. That seems to be what will happen. If it gets too hot, it'll dry out faster. In the water, though, it's buffered by the environment, and it might get cold, but not cold enough. You can also look, we have had, looked at the phenology of this over time, the patterns over time throughout the year, and they've set up this really cool camera system to look at starry stonewort under the ice, and it's greener longer. It's growing, it's down there. It's just fine at 36 degrees at the bottom of a lake in the middle of winter. And I should also mention, we've also done environmental suitability modeling for it under current and future climate scenarios, just to get a perspective of, although it's showing up here and it's still in about 13 lakes right now, what might a future look like with the species spreading in the state? So we kind of looked at it in a kind of a forward-looking direction as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick question. Back a few decades ago, I was attending school at the University of Minnesota and worked with Professor Ray Newman on a project with Eurasian water milfoil and weevils. And so curious, I think that I've heard that it's kind of coming back in vogue as a treatment, or at least it was. I don't know. Maybe you can just help me explain or help me understand that. And then also, what are the treatments for this hybrid form of milfoil?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ray is still there. Dr. Newman is still there. He's still working very hard. He's leading the hybrid water milfoil project right now. He's done quite a bit with weevils. There seems to be a resurgence in interest in using that as a management option, which the research would suggest is possible. We know weevils will eat the stems. They burrow into the stem of the milfoil plant and kill it. The problem is it's unpredictable. The success is unpredictable. Bluegills love to eat them. So if you got lots of bluegills, it's going to be a problem with the weevils. They also need some overwintering habitat. And depending on the structure and the shoreline of the lake, it's not always a suitable situation. So while it's a management strategy, it's not a one-size-fits-all option. So word of caution for people that are trying to deploy it. The treatment options that exist right now for the hybrid variety are uncertain. We are currently, and this is what Ray's working on right now, kind of matching up the genetic pattern with treatment outcomes to see what's worked and what hasn't, and at what concentrations. People aren't applying herbicides at the same levels in the same areas in every lake, so a lot of, and under the same conditions, it's a lot of variability, a lot of confounding factors that can come into play that need to be sorted out, but they are working on it now, and I'm optimistic by the end of their project, which is scheduled to end here in June, they'll have, they may be able to report back on kind of a, you know, protocol, best case scenario anyways of what we know now, but I foresee more work in that area as we learn more about this kind of evolving species.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the benefit of folks who haven't seen the vats of starry stonewort that they have at the lab, it's it kind of looks like the upside down from Stranger Things. Like it's not like your typical plant structure. So it's so helpful to go tour their lab if you haven't had the chance to do that. I'm sure they could facilitate doing that at a time that's convenient for folks, but it's really helpful to actually know what it looks like when we're talking about all these things. So, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Phelps, I've been on Lake Coronis and I've seen the starry stonewort, and it's pretty ugly, and I've actually talked to some of the Lake Association members and some of the efforts that we're trying to do. I'm curious to know, they mentioned Dr. Rogers, I believe at Clemson University. Mm-hmm. What can you help the committee understand his role in this and how you may be collaborating with him?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, so Lake Coronis has been kind of ground zero of starry stonewort research. We have quite a bit of activity going on in that lake, as does Dr. Rogers. He's, like you said, from Clemson. He's been hired directly by the Lake Association, from what I understand. His interests are largely focused on treatment options, and he's been doing lab trials down there at Clemson and piloting things up here with the Lake Association on treatment. We're learning everything we can. We see him at conferences. I know Dr. Larkin, who's kind of our starry stonework guy on our side, they interact, trying to coordinate and learn from each other. What we're doing differently is we have a bigger perspective. We're doing more on starry stonewort than just the treatment, and that's where Rogers comes in. So he's playing an important role in this as well, and we're trying to be as coordinated as we can with other researchers too. We're not possessive about our study sites. We're open. I hope everybody comes and works in Minnesota. That would be awesome, and to have interest from Clemson is a great opportunity, I think, for the state.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I, too, was at the Lake Coronas a couple of years ago. And as I recall, the Lake Association folks were working on some mechanical harvesting of the stonewort. Is that just a stopgap measure, or is it at all effective in treatment?
So, Mr. Chair, I'm representative. The harvesting is mechanical harvesting. Think of it like a lawnmower for the lake, just kind of like rolls along the water and just chops it up and tries to get it out. It is effective for nuisance control. And I think when anybody's setting out to do mechanical removal, they're coming in with that as their goal. They shouldn't be thinking of it as some sort of suppression of a population or something. It's just nuisance control. This is also important and relevant for Eurasian water milfoil. This is an active discussion on Lake Minnetonka right now. The drawback of mechanical harvesting is that it's expensive, it's indefinite, and as you chop it up with starry stonewort and Eurasian water milfoil, those little bits can recede. You're not going to get it all out of the water. They try to. They've got this like contraption, this conveyor belt that brings it up. But it's going to be put back in the lake. It's like replanting itself. So while it serves a very important purpose for navigation channels, perhaps, or kind of spot treatment, spot control, it's not a long-term solution.
Questioned you out.
All right. But, Mr. Chair, I do encourage you, and I'll thank Representative Becker Finn for putting it out there. Our doors are always open. We're on the St. Paul campus. Swing on over. Check out the lab. Talk to the students. It'd be great for you to kind of see this in action if it's at all possible with your schedules.
Please, Dr. Phelps, relay our gratitude to your staff and other folks you work with there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I waited till the last minute because it's kind of off subject, so I didn't want to jump in the middle of discussion. But, Doctor, I'm curious. You mentioned earlier there's a spinoff company from the U of M that's out there performing treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is it the university? Is it professors doing it on their own? Is it former students who have started their own company? What is this private company made up of? How did it start?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question, and it's an awesome story. The University of Minnesota has, under the direction, I think, strongly led by President Kaler, has really helped to facilitate this path to commercialization of various research lines for all sorts of human health, whatever. This is one of those where the university provided support to a faculty member to create a company based on the research that they had done. It's Dr. Prashant Bayer who's leading the effort. It's his company. It's aptly named CARP Solutions. And if you look at, he works part-time. He's a full-time faculty member right now. This is a side gig. He has employees that run it. It's cool to see the company roster. Many of them are former graduate students that have come through our program at the university and are now out there employed doing work to solve the problems. I mean, this is exactly what the university model is built on. Let's do the work, let's train the students, and let's solve the problem. And so I think along those lines, it's a great example of what the university is all about, and MACIRC is happy to have been a part of that.
One follow-up, if I may. That's a wonderful success story, and I'm glad to hear it. The only thing that would make it better is if these startup companies that are started through funding dollars from the state be required to give 10 or 20% back to promote more research at the U of M rather than needing more funding from the state of Minnesota. But other than that, it's a great story.
And Mr. Chair, it's a case-by-case basis depending on how the technology was developed. But there are examples where I think the norm for technology commercialization is a third stays with the university, a third goes back to the researcher's department or research program, and a third goes to the researcher themselves. It's a case-by-case basis. I don't know how Progenic Buyer has it set up, but there is a way. And there's also a way, I should point out, too, if the technology is developed with state resources, so if LCCMR, the ENRTF were to fund it, the technology or commercialization of it, there's a way to recoup that cost from the research. So that's an important thing to keep track of as R&D is developed. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. My understanding is that the EU has a patent right.
Yep, depending on the type of technology.
Sure, yeah. Sure. Well, good. Don't see any other questions coming at us here. Did you have a question, Representative Fabian, or a comment?
Well, just a comment. He mentioned the Environmental Resources Trust Fund. You know, I served on the LCCMR for a couple of years, and that was one of the things that was used to promote some of the projects that were coming forward. And so at some point, because it could go commercial. And then they talked about how if ENRTF funds had been used for the development of this technology or this private sector company, then there was going to be a payback. And then I asked one day in committee, and maybe Ms. Taylor or somebody, nonpartisan staff, can help us out, so how much money has the state of Minnesota recouped from these different projects? And I was told zero. So I'm not sure if things aren't going commercial or if things aren't being reported back correctly. Have I got that kind of right, Ms. Taylor?
Okay. Well, we're looking into further, I think, Representative Fabian, because that wasn't the understanding that I had either. I thought that there would be something coming back. And I'd be another day. We run out of time. But thank you all for your, Dr. Phelps, for your good presentation and your patience in answering questions, and all of members for your questions, staff for all your help. And we stand adjourned.